From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and as the stock market touches new highs today, many Americans are returning their Christmas presents. According to Oracle, 77% of consumers are expected to return some of their presents this year. 20% are expected to return more than half. And while they're returning, many will also spend more money. So let's start the hour with our business segment and Robin Farzad, who hosts Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
How big a day is this for retailers?
Look, there's still a retail feeding frenzy, even after everything we've experienced since Thanksgiving. Obviously, returns galore. Stores are still full of these buy one, get one free LCD TV offers, and they're stocked up on seasonal stuff, and Amazon wants in. I saw a stat from the National Retail Federation's annual December survey. It says 68% of people said they'll likely shop the week after Christmas, with 49% saying they plan to take advantage of post-holiday sales.
And when you look at all of the holiday sales so far, President Trump was tweeting about it, that they were up from last year. But we do see, according to Adobe Analytics, that online shoppers spent more than $125 billion this holiday season, which is a 13% increase from last year.
And to think that online sales are still a minority of overall sales, but this quickens a trend that took shape more than a decade ago. We have total U.S. retail sales for November through Christmas Eve up about 3.4% from a year earlier. But if you look at the MasterCard numbers, online sales were up 19% versus growth of just 1.2% for in-store sales.
And by the way, 35% of that $125 billion was on smartphones. And I was looking back at Apple's stock while the rest of the market is up something like 20% over the last year. Apple stock has almost doubled.
It's unbelievable. Apple's now worth $1.3 trillion. And nobody talks about these incremental milestones after $1 trillion, 1.1, 1.2. But then if you look at the other horsemen of tech, Amazon, Facebook, Google, they're all feeling omnipotent, you know, with their stocks at or near all-time highs to close out the decade. It's really the era of the platforms that dominate the smartphone. Whether you have an Apple phone or an Android phone, there are five or six players that completely dominate their categories.
Robin, how are shipping companies keeping up with all the demand this year? So many people going online to buy things instead of going into the stores.
Yeah, a lot of ink recently on how difficult Amazon is making life for the likes of FedEx and UPS. I mean, the retailing colossus, it's just investing gobs on vans, planes, runways, drones. And what you see is two-day free delivery is now the industry standard. That used to just affect retailers, but now FedEx is kind of in this existential crisis. And there's speculation that FedEx or UPS is going to need a deep-pocketed savior. If you look at some of the stuff written in the financial press after Christmas, there's talk of Warren Buffett or Walmart with an infusion to help them keep up with Amazon. And I think it's shaping to be one of the big disruptions of our era. And I wonder what the U.S. Postal Service is thinking. Maybe they're chomping on popcorn while the deeper-pocketed rivals suffer.
Yeah. One more thing I want to ask you about, Robin, that in addition to being a very busy shopping day today, it is also a very busy travel day, one of the busiest of the year.
Yeah, AAA notes that vehicle travel is up about 4% from last year. And as for the skies, this is an interesting stat. Yeah, AAA predicts nearly 7 million more Americans are going to be flying, the most since 2003. So more than 115 million people are expected to travel 50 miles or more from their homes for the holiday periods. And we have a very tacked system, whether it's, you know, the airports, TSA line and whatnot. And you throw one or two or three other intervening variables such as weather or unexpected worker shortage or something else like that, and it completely gums up the entire system. So, you know, good luck on the airports and on the roads.
That is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks so much. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Jeremy. Thank you.
We are just a few days away from January 1st, when new laws will go into effect around the country. In California, one of those new laws will limit when police officers can use deadly force. It was a response to the 2018 police shooting of a man named Stephon Clark in Sacramento. Laurel Rosenhall of the Cal Matters podcast Force of Law has the story, and a warning, it does include the sound of gunshots.
911, what's location of the emergency?
This guy's going down the street breaking windows of cars. He busted both my truck windows out.
On the night of March 18th, 2018, a little after 9, a man calls the police to report suspicious activity in his neighborhood.
The male in a black hoodie or complainant has a visual of him still.
Two officers drive over to check things out. And then...
Show me your hands! Get your gun!
Stefan Clark was holding a cell phone, not a gun. The officer shot at him 20 times, killing the 22-year-old in his grandparents' backyard. He was one of 115 Californians that police shot dead in 2018. Stefan Clark's death prompted California to make it harder to legally justify police use of deadly force. In an early 2019 speech on the state Capitol steps, the sponsor of this bill, Democratic Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, drew upon her family history to explain why.
And so I stand here as a daughter of a sharecropper who has lived through the horrors of racism and the injustices of the judicial system. And I have to recognize the fact that things need to change.
Yeah. Her bill set off a major political battle. Democrats dominate in California's capital, but law enforcement has a lot of clout. And at first, police fought hard against the proposal.
Under the new standard, an officer cannot use deadly force if there is any other reasonable alternative.
Randy Perry lobbies for California's law enforcement unions. In 2018, he testified against that proposed standard at a Capitol hearing.
If someone can later identify any alternative the officer should have used, then the officer's actions are now unlawful under this bill. Waiting until all other options are exhausted will be deadly for officers and citizen victims.
Lobbying for the bill were civil rights activists and a surprising number of Californians whose loved ones had died at the hands of police.
My name is Teresa Smith. I'm the mother of Cesar Cruz, who was shot 15 times in the back by five police officers in Anaheim. And I'm here today supporting this bill instead of celebrating his birthday today.
An 8-year-old boy supported the bill, too.
My name is Josiah Antonio Guzman Lopez, and I don't want anybody to grow up without a dad like me.
Josiah's mother, Lori Valdez, told me later about the day her partner died. His name was Antonio Guzman Lopez.
It was like 7:30 in the evening when I get a text message.
From her partner's niece.
We just found out my tío Toño has been killed, that he got in a fight with a cop and they killed him. And I remember looking at it and I'm like, what?
The district attorney justified the shooting because Guzman Lopez was holding a saw blade and moving toward the officer when he shot. An autopsy found methamphetamine in his system. Valdez knew her partner didn't understand English and was afraid of the police. So she saw him not as a menace, but as a man trying to run for his life. For officers, the threat of death is also very real. David Wallace is retired from the Modesto, California Police Department. In 2016, his brother Dennis, a sheriff's deputy in the same area, stopped to check out a stolen vehicle. The driver shot him in the head.
I already lost my brother. You know, I've been to 74 line of duty death funerals.
Across the United States, about 100 officers die on the job each year. But studies show that the danger to police is down drastically from a couple of generations ago. A researcher who has examined killings of and by police says the same factor heightens the threat in both situations.
Civilian gun ownership.
Franklin Zimring teaches law at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of When Police Kill. He repeats what lots of officers say, that whenever they show up at a call, they may face people with guns.
And because they are dangerous, police are much more apt to use life-threatening force against civilians.
California lawmakers urged Assemblywoman Weber to compromise. She did remove elements the police opposed most strongly, including the provision that said officers could only use deadly force when there were no reasonable alternatives. After more than a year of debate and emotional testimony at the Capitol, Stefan Clark's family stood alongside California Governor Gavin Newsom for a bill signing ceremony in August 2019.
I'm ready to sign this damn thing, so why don't we just cut to the chase? But I didn't know.
The law says police may only use deadly force when necessary in defense of human life. It also says authorities may review officers' actions that lead up to a shooting. Even so, Black Lives Matter withdrew its support, saying the bill wouldn't change policing nearly enough. Other groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, still stand behind it. A few days after he signed the law, I asked the governor how he'll judge its success.
Substantial reduction in the number of fatal shootings.
And so do you have like a number you're hoping for?
No. I mean, we want zero. That's the number. I mean, that's the goal. But no one's naive. And there are completely justifiable instances where that use of force is appropriate.
Throughout her fight to pass the law, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber invoked a sense of hope for future generations.
All we have ever asked for in this country is to be treated with dignity, to respect our lives like you respect other people's lives, and give our children and our grandchildren a chance to grow and to develop.
Now her bill carries the force of law in the nation's most populous state. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Rosenhall.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Looking back on 2019, one of my favorite music conversations of the year started this way. That's North Carolina folk duo Mandolin Orange. They're touring through the month of January to promote their latest album, Tides of a Teardrop. It's full of soulful harmonies like the one you can hear on this track, Time We Made Time.
It's time we made time just for talking. It's time we made time to heal. But I know she'll be there when I'm lonesome. Tell me just how I
Tides of a Teardrop is the sixth album by Mandolin Orange, and in February, we spoke with the people behind the music. Songwriter Andrew Marlin plays the mandolin, the guitar, and the banjo. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And vocalist Emily France, who also plays the violin and the guitar. Emily, it's good to speak with you as well.
Great to be here.
Well, let's get right away to one of my favorite songs on the new album, Golden Embers.
Just like an old friend, kinder than expected. That Cadillac came and gave our girl a ride.
Andrew, tell me about that song.
That was a song that I started kind of ironing out some old, deep feelings that I'd been harboring for a long time with the loss of my mom. And I think there's a lot of things that didn't get talked about between me and my family, and especially me and my dad. And so that was a song that I wrote to him, trying to just kind of get all the bad feelings out of the way and shine some more positive light on positive memories of my mom.
Tell me something about her.
She's always had a warm smile for everybody. Never heard anyone say a bad word about her. And she used to be a piano player for the church. So I think through her, I developed a love for old hymns and, you know, just her enthusiasm towards music.
Hmm. There's a line in there in that song that says, "If you could help me share the trouble." It's a reminder that, like, even when two people are grieving, you and your father, you're also just grieving alone.
Yeah, you think that that grief would bring you together, but really it kind of separates you. It builds these walls, because with us, we're kind of dealing with them separately. Where I think if we could actually talk about it among ourselves, there'd be a lot of healing through that.
If you could help me share the trouble that you've got burning in you, then you can help me and end our time together. Her memory will ever shine like golden embers in the night.
You know, I watched the video for that song, and I was at my desk, and a coworker came up behind me and was trying to get my attention about something else completely. And I was so wrapped into this video, so heartbreaking to see this little boy, who presumably is playing a younger version of yourself, dealing with the loneliness that comes with death. I didn't even know somebody was standing behind me. It's a little embarrassing, but I mean, it does speak to, you were 18. People do lose their parents, but not at such a young age, typically.
Yeah, and, you know, I felt like that video was really powerful, too, and I probably shed a few tears the first time I saw the edit. Some of the guys that made the video experienced the loss of a parent at a young age, too, and so it felt like they really nailed just the portrayal of that in a way that felt really honest and not over the top.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more from the album. This is the chorus of Suspended in Heaven.
Mother is gone, her journey's on end. You see her pass by in the night sky glow. And she'll see the blue of the ocean's rise. The tides of a tear.
Emily, you know what I love about that is that you both harmonize so, so well. Your voices just blend together. How does that happen?
It's a great question. I'm not really sure. Andrew and I used to talk about this when we first started singing together because we felt like there wasn't necessarily anything tonally about our voices that went well together, but that we just try and sing really straight and evenly, and that somehow that kind of lends itself to blending the two together.
I think Emily's selling herself short there because I've definitely got a lilt and, you know, some timing things that I go to and do, and she's really good about following those. And I would say a lot of that is due to Emily's ability to sing harmony. Hmm.
Could I put you on the spot a little bit and ask you to sing here for me?
We can try. Andrew's voice is sort of on the...
I'm on the rocks right now just because I'm fighting the cold, but we can give it a shot. Okay.
That'd be great.
If you could help me to share the trouble.
No, my voice is shot.
Well, what's it feel like when you do hit it, when you nail it and you know you got it right?
It is such a good feeling. There's like this buzz that you hear. It's almost like there's a third voice there, which in that Suspended in Heaven chorus, there is a third voice, Josh Oliver singing with us. But when we're singing just the two of us live or on any track and you hit just that perfect sort of critical point, it's almost like there's an extra sound in there.
The highway hums a lullaby and she's sleeping on side of the street.
Now, I hear your sound, and I think back to Graham Parsons and to Emmylou Harris. Do you think that's a fair comparison? I've seen it written elsewhere, but that was the first thing that came to my mind when I listened to your music.
I love that, because I'm a big fan of theirs, and definitely a big fan of Graham Parsons' songwriting. So I think that's a fair comparison.
Yeah, I've never felt like I could sing anything like Emmylou Harris, and probably nobody can. But there is a certain way that she sings harmony that is so distinct, and especially on a lot of those old Graham Parsons recordings. It's different from what we hear in a lot of bluegrass and folk music because she's not singing that tenor part that's right above his. Hmm. She'll jump around and do these parts that are way higher and kind of set her voice apart a lot.
Take me down to your dance floor. I won't mind people when they stare. Paint a different color on your front door. And tomorrow we will still be there.
I like to try and take a little bit from that and jump around and do different parts when it feels natural.
Let's backtrack a little for listeners who might not be completely familiar with your work. You met in 2009 in North Carolina, and I discovered you personally on YouTube. You were doing this beautiful cover of the Bob Dylan song Boots of Spanish Leather. Let's listen to some of that.
Is there something I can send you from across the sea? From the place where I'll be landing.
No, there's nothing you can send me, my own true love. For there's nothing I'm wishing to be owning.
I've heard some people say that's the best version of that song that they've ever heard. Why do you think that people have such a connection with it?
I'm really not sure. It's funny because we've been singing that song for so many years. It was one of the first songs that we ever worked out together when we were starting to play music. And it is one that I guess not that many people have played it in that sort of call and response style.
Where you sing and then Andrew sings, right?
Yeah.
I think it gets the story across and kind of puts it into perspective. I remember the first time I heard the song, I was really intrigued by it. It was on the Bob Dylan's The Times They Are Changing record. And when it finally hit me that it was actually a conversation, it was like, man, okay, this needs to take place. This conversation needs to happen. And so I was really stoked when Emily was down to learn all the lyrics because there's a bunch of them. And I think it was like the first song we really sat down to work out together.
Well, let's go out with one more song from the new album. I'm going to make it songwriter's choice here.
We could do Into the Sun.
Sure.
That's one that Emily sings that is one of my favorites on the record. Is actually one that I wrote about her grandfather. We got to spend some time with him when he was kind of getting close to leaving this world. And we would just sit down and listen to him tell stories.
And he had such a love for travel and specifically driving. And he was of such a different generation than us. And I don't think could entirely wrap his head around what we do for a living. But we could relate when we talked about travel and driving and highways, and he loved that we went to so many places, and he saw that as such a form of education. So a lot of that part of his personality is wrapped up in that song too.
Emily Franz and Andrew Marlin are Mandolin Orange. Their latest album, Tides of a Teardrop, is out now. It is beautiful. Thank you so much for making it. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
I spoke with Mandolin Orange back in February. Today, police in Moscow raided the office of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. We're still learning more about what happened, but the anti-corruption activist has been a constant thorn in Vladimir Putin's government. Let's bring in Lucian Kim. He's NPR's international correspondent based in Moscow. Hi, Lucian.
Hi, Peter.
And I understand you were at Navalny's office just a few minutes before this raid happened. What do we know?
Well, I was there just a bit earlier, maybe about a half hour earlier. I was interviewing Navalny's spokeswoman. And the reason for that was one of the people who works in Navalny's anti-corruption foundation disappeared earlier this week. His name is Ruslan Shavadinov. He's 23 years old. And on Monday night, it turns out his phone was switched off by his mobile operator. Then the police came to his apartment and took him away. He turned up later 1,000 miles away on a restricted island in the Arctic Ocean where there's a military base, and he was drafted into the army.
And is that related to why the authorities showed up at the office today?
Well, it was a bit puzzling why they came today. Navalny's people say it was already the fourth raid by police just since August. And Navalny has now said he believes they came because they wanted to prevent him from doing one of his weekly shows, which gathers sometimes hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube.
And we see that Navalny says he was not arrested, but he was dragged out of the offices forcefully. Police appear to have removed equipment from those offices. And let's just back up and remind people that he's been a thorn in Putin's government for years. He tried to run for president last year, but he was barred from doing so. And as you've hinted at, he's kind of made it a mission of his to expose corruption in Russia. So the Kremlin sees him as a threat. But what about the Russian people? Is he seen more of a victim or an agitator there?
Well, that's a great question. We pay a lot of attention to Alexei Navalny because he is sort of the loudest critic of Vladimir Putin. He's very effective on social media. But on the other hand, when you look at opinion polls, it seems like Navalny isn't that well known. I just actually returned from a town outside of Moscow. Navalny, I think, to the large mass of Russian people, is still not so present. And probably the single most important reason for that is that there's basically a boycott on state media of any appearance and any mention of the name Alexei Navalny.
Huh. So what's your sense of how far Navalny seems to be willing to push the patience of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government? I mean, he's been arrested many times. He's been put under house arrest. How far is he willing to go?
Well, I think everyone wants to know that. He's really shown incredible resilience and good humor even about this raid. He's been tweeting out memes. But he's under extreme pressure. His foundation, this anti-corruption foundation, is the subject of a money laundering investigation. His organization has also been branded a foreign agent by the government. One expert I recently talked to told me she thinks the purpose of all this pressure is just to get him to leave the country finally. Hmm. He's really stepped on so many toes. There are so many powerful people in Russia who would just like to see him gone. Hmm. But he and his people, like this young man, Ruslan Shavadinov, they say they're here to stay.
That's NPR's Lucian Kim, international correspondent based in Moscow. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
With less than a week left in this decade, we're going to look back now at some of the most important scientific events of the 2010s. The first clear image of a black hole, a revolutionary method for modifying genes, and more proof that a theory Albert Einstein proposed more than a century ago is correct. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca joins us now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. So let's start with Einstein and the theory of general relativity. What happened in this last decade to prove that it was correct?
Well, there's been several things that have proved him correct over the years, but this last decade was really cool because one of his predictions was when two giant objects collided, they would put out these things called gravitational waves. And Jeremy, this is why I'm a science correspondent, because I get to say ripples in space-time. Mm-hmm. That's what these gravitational waves are. And there's an instrument here in the United States called LIGO,
yes,
which was built to detect these. And for many years, it wasn't able to because they weren't sensitive enough. And Einstein thought these gravitational waves would never be detected. But when they upgraded the instrument in 2015 and some short time after they turned it on, they saw a signal which exactly matched what they were expecting to see when two black holes collided. And that's what they think they saw.
And gravitational waves, LIGO, that won a Nobel Prize in this last decade.
Yep. Once it was found, everybody said, yep, that's a Nobel Prize.
Okay. Well, one of the other science stories that captured people's interest in the past decade was the total solar eclipse that swept across the United States in 2017. Here's how a crowd in Oregon reacted to the phenomenon as it was happening.
This is so totally creepy.
Oh my God, the sun!
So, Joe, not the first solar eclipse ever, not the last, but pretty significant still.
Well, yeah, I mean, people got really fascinated by just the physical phenomenon. And I have to say, I was in Chile this year for a similar event, and it was happening in Chile. There was eclipse fever. There are some things that scientists like to study when the moon passes in front of the sun, and you can study the outer atmosphere of the solar corona, it's called. But mostly it's the public imagination that was captured by this event.
I remember that I was in probably the worst place in the United States to view that eclipse, which was at Acadia National Park in Maine, which was very far away. But it was still cool because I was in a restaurant and everybody in the restaurant came and borrowed the same glasses so that they could look at the solar eclipse as it was happening.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, Jeremy, there's a difference between a partial solar eclipse and a total solar eclipse. Mm-hmm. Once you see the total solar eclipse, you know what they're talking about,
yeah,
because it is a really odd phenomenon when the lights go down and it's like you're sitting in a theater waiting for the show to begin.
And an eclipse was also important in proving Einstein's theory, right?
That was another thing that eclipses did in 1919, so going back 100 years. Einstein's theory of relativity suggested that the sun would bend light coming from a distant star. But there was no way to see stars that were close to the sun because the sun's too bright, except when there's an eclipse. So they measured these bright stars that were right near the sun when the eclipse took place, and they were able to see them for a few seconds, measure their position accurately, and then compare that to where a star chart said they were supposed to be. And sure enough, the bending of the light exactly fit what Einstein predicted from his theory.
Okay, other news from the solar system, where scientists discovered the first known interstellar object to visit our solar system. Tell us more about that.
Well, this was actually discovered after it had already come in and was jetting away. It was called Oumuamua. I think I said that right. And it's just a rock that came from out there. And nobody's really sure where it came from, or they can probably plot its trajectory to see where it's going. But it just shows that there are things floating around in space that we haven't seen. Well, this one we happened to spot. And in fact, there was another one just spotted this year, which was a comet. The comet being a ball of dust and ice. And so, Jeremy, you want to wear a hard hat when you're out, you know, looking around in the solar system.
We also got to see the first image of a black hole this year.
Yeah, now that was also interesting. It took a group of telescopes all across the planet to all point at this one black hole in a galaxy 55 million light years from Earth. And by all pointing at the same time in the same spot in the same region with this distributed network of telescopes, they were actually able to see this round blackness, which was, of course, the black hole. And around it, you can see the light from stars and other bright objects that are being pulled into it. So it's a pretty amazing picture.
Okay, Joe, back here on Earth, this decade marked the end of an era in the American space program.
All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff. The final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle. America will continue the dream.
So NASA ended the space shuttle program. What did we gain from this program, and why did they decide to end it?
Well, we gained a space station, essentially. I mean, that was the primary reason that the space shuttle program existed. It was the only rocket in our fleet, essentially, that was strong enough to carry the bits of the space station up into space. They ended it because it was very expensive, and the space station was largely built, and there seemed like there would be other ways of getting astronauts into space that would be less expensive. It wasn't supposed to take this long for the United States to come up with an alternate method. So for the last intervening 8 years or so, we've been relying on the Russians to carry our contribution, our astronauts up to the space station. Of course, they carry their cosmonauts and they bring them back. But there are some commercial projects that are supposed to maybe next year, maybe the year after, that we'll be carrying astronauts into space. That's the plan.
Okay. Well, we have to talk about some other areas of science, because we're talking about the biggest science stories of the decade. And in biology, scientists in Germany did something this past decade that two decades ago would have been more like science fiction. What was it?
Yeah, well, this one really blows me away. It was the ability to do a complete genome sequence. That's being able to log all the DNA base pairs of a Neanderthal. Now, remember, Neanderthals are extinct. So this was data that was taken from bones and teeth from individuals that haven't been alive for tens of thousands of years. So it's just such an amazing tour de force that you can actually get DNA from these remnants, in many cases fossilized remnants, and still have it coherent enough to make its measurement. And not only did they get the Neanderthals, they got something called the Denisovans, which was a species, a whole civilization that was only known by a tiny pinky bone about a decade ago. They found a few more bones since, but the idea that this genetic sequence tells you you're talking about a whole new civilization, that's pretty amazing.
And speaking of genetics, this past decade brought us CRISPR, this gene-modifying tool, which was monumental.
Right. You know, every once in a while, something comes along in biology that just changes the game. And CRISPR did that. It allowed scientists to make changes in living cells They think of it like a DNA editor, essentially. Of course, there were some controversial uses of this technology. Somebody did this in embryos, and there were children born in China that were edited using CRISPR. That part of the technology is a bit controversial, but there's a lot of other uses of the technology, not just in medicine, but in biology writ large, that is giving scientists an entirely new way to look at the biological world.
Now, Joe, we obviously can't get to everything in a 10-minute segment here, but what else sort of stands out to you as some of the biggest science stories of the decade?
Well, I mean, of course, there was this discovery of the Higgs boson, which is a particle that helps explain why things have mass. There was a much better understanding of how global warming was affecting storms on Earth. And in the last decade, we sent a probe that flew past Pluto. Nobody knew what Pluto looked like, and now we have a pretty good picture of it. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we didn't talk about that we could have certainly put as candidates for the most important science stories of the last decade.
Well, and for the scientists who are listening, if they have other thoughts about big science stories, go to our website, hereandnow.org, and let us know. But Joe, what can we be looking forward to in the next decade? What are some of the big scientific breakthroughs on the horizon?
I really like that question because I can say quite honestly, I have no idea. I mean, if you look at it, Jeremy, the paper entitled A Programmable Dual RNA-Guided DNA Endonuclease and Adaptive Bacterial Immunity didn't catch my attention when it came out in 2012, but that's the CRISPR revolution.
Oh,
that
wow.
was the paper that started the whole thing. So there may have been a paper this week or last month that will look completely innocuous to me, you know, and many other people, and it'll change the way we see the world. So I'm really happy to say I don't know what we're going to see, but we'll see something interesting, I'm sure.
That is NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
This month, we've been talking about housing affordability in a few mid-size cities, places like Durham, North Carolina, and in the Mountain West, Missoula, Montana, and Salt Lake City. Communities in New Mexico are seeing a rise in homelessness as home prices hit record highs. Daniel Werwath is Chief Operating Officer of New Mexico Interfaith Housing. It's a nonprofit affordable housing developer based in Santa Fe. Daniel, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And we've been looking at numbers that show last year the median home price in your city hit a record, $370,000. Why? What's driving up the cost of housing in Santa Fe?
Well, there's a bunch of factors. At the core of it is a supply and demand issue. We've sort of failed to keep up with population growth in producing housing. A lot of that's from, you know, a lingering after effect of the economic downturn. But there's a lot of factors that are sort of combining to make housing less accessible than really it's ever been.
And if supply is a problem, I'm guessing you don't have enough affordable housing. Is that right?
Both, right? There's really two affordable housing crises going on simultaneously. One is that there's not enough income and rent-restricted housing for very low-income people, people with limited means. And then a secondary problem, which is just the supply and demand problem, where you actually see affordability issues starting to creep up into middle-income earners and affecting people like teachers and nurses and first responders.
We've been hearing a lot about how hard it is to build affordable housing in many cities because zoning can be an issue. The high cost of land can be a problem. Is that something that you're seeing in Santa Fe? Are there other challenges that you're facing?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. We've never had a more difficult time to build housing, especially affordable housing. You know, the combination of restrictive zoning, large lot zoning, things like historic overlays, and really cumbersome regulatory processes combined with record high construction costs. You know, the trade wars affecting commodity prices, we're really seeing the highest cost development environment in my 15 years of working on affordable housing development.
Yeah, tell me more about that. Give me an idea of how much it cost to build a new home?
Well, so in the most of my work lately has been working on building apartments, because that's where the really big need is in Santa Fe right now. And, you know, a good way to think about it, the Siler Yard project, which we're currently developing, is a 65-unit apartment complex, and it will be over $18 million to build that when it's said and done. So in many cases, we're looking at more than $200,000 a unit. You just can't, in hard costs, produce housing at levels that are affordable for many working families. And in reality, Santa Fe, what we've got now is 73% of families that earn less than $50,000 a year, renter families, wow, are paying more than they can afford for housing right now.
Which is a problem, because if something happens in their life, then suddenly they lose a job and they could be homeless, which we've been hearing about across the Mountain West during the course of these conversations. And I understand you've worked in the West, in other cities outside of Santa Fe. I mean, have you noticed that there's a single solution or a policy that would help anywhere? Are some cities doing a better job tackling this problem than others?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the answer, there's no silver bullet, right? And really the answer is a lot of different solutions running simultaneously. I think local investment in affordable housing is a really big one. You know, the federal government only provides about a fifth of the resources needed to serve the families with the most limited means in our communities. And so state and local governments really need to step up and meet that gap. I think land use reform is another really big one. It's really a range of solutions and trying lots of different strategies that really address housing issues across the income spectrum. So literally everything from homelessness to foreclosure, you really need to find interventions and be working on those at the local level, working with nonprofit partners and the private sector collaboratively to try and solve these problems.
Speaking of the private sector, do you get the sense that there is a desire by developers who would rather build, you know, a luxury home or a project that would yield a big return on their investment rather than a lower cost affordable housing project? I mean, is that a real dynamic?
There's certainly an incentive to develop higher end housing always because the margins are bigger. And, you know, places like Santa Fe, we have inclusionary policies which, you know, make developers include a certain affordability component in new development. But really, I think a lot of the smartest policies right now are looking towards incentives to help bring the private sector into the below market housing production realm. And then really, you know, the other piece is just, you know, having local governments lay the groundwork through really smart and progressive land use policy. Unfortunately, you know, I think a lot of our values, Santa Fe is a very, you know, value-oriented city, believes in equity, believes in environmental sustainability. But that's not really reflected in our land use policies. It's not really reflected in our zoning. So we don't have the base tools that we need to solve these problems right now.
That's Dan Werwath, Chief Operating Officer of New Mexico Interfaith Housing. It's a nonprofit developer of low-cost, affordable homes. Daniel, thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and we are live on this day after Christmas, Here and Now.